Okay, everyone. So our topic for tonight is the rabbis and the question of slavery. So we're going to address the various opinions held by members of the American Jewish clergy, the rabbinate, although not everybody really was a real rabbi, they were just clergy, with respect to issues of secession, of war and peace, and of slavery versus abolition. You might ask, why is this a relevant topic? Well, I mean, we're studying Jewish history, so whatever the rabbis say seems to be relevant, but actually, this topic it proves relevant even in general American history, because as it turned out, people cared about what the Jewish clergy had to say. After all, what's the Bible? The Bible is the Old Testament. Well, it's in Hebrew, and who were the original recipients of the Old Testament? The Israelites, the Jews, the Hebrews. So on this occasion, for whatever reason, the Christian clergy and the general American laity were curious to know what the Jewish ecclesiastics had to say on so sensitive a topic. Okay, and they had a lot of things to say. Well, let's start with the heavy hitter, Isaac Meir Wise, whom we discussed a few weeks ago. So Isaac Meir Wise, who from 1854 and onward for the rest of his career was living in Cincinnati. So Cincinnati is a border state. You know, Ohio is a border state, and Wise is a Democrat. He thought that abolitionists were fanatical anti-Semites, and he liked Stephen Douglas's policy of live and let live, and he was opposed to Lincoln. He wanted peace and sectional self-determination in order to maintain the Union, even if it meant acquiescing to slavery. Okay, he was all right with that. Wise was politically mobile, meaning he didn't have a real ideology and a fixed set of positions. He would go with whichever way the wind was blowing, as suited his personal interests. He started off leaning towards the Republicans, but then he switched to the Democrats. Then he vowed to keep silent, possibly because his shul told him to be quiet, alternatively because he had friends on both sides of the border and did not want to alienate people. And then he almost ran for office as a Democrat until his congregants told him to stop because they wanted him in shul for davening and not in the state capitol. He was ambivalent. Actually, in my view, he had no principles other than vocally defending the Jews against any perceived or actual discrimination. So if he thought the Jews were getting cheated out of their rights, he would raise a ruckus, and that was sincere. But pretty much everything else was just out of convenience. Now, Isaac Meir Wise traveled a lot on business, the business of the rabbinate. He knew many politicians, and he was especially close to Salmon Chase. If you know your American history, he was a U.S. senator from Ohio, would go on to become the Secretary of War, and then would go on to become the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States. So Wise was not limited to his parish. He wasn't just a congregational rabbi with narrow horizons. He had big horizons. Like, Rabbi Norman Lamb used to say about Rabbi Arthur Schneier, that he's the foreign secretary of the American rabbinate. So Isaac Meir Wise, in his time, was the one who knew all the politicians. He was like the foreign secretary of the American rabbinate. But Cincinnati had strong ties, commercial ties to the South. And that's going to play an important role in determining Wise's political leanings, because he doesn't want to offend his city and the commercial interests of his city, and for that matter, his customers, because he runs a newspaper and he has subscribers all over the country, including in the South. Okay. Now, the Jewish community of Cincinnati was Yekki. It was mostly German. It was young, and they were recently arrived, meaning there were very few Jews in Cincinnati in the 1820s and 30s. It was a brand new city. In the 1840s, it grew substantially. In the 1850s, it grew even more substantially. By the time the Civil War rolled around, there were 10,000 to 12,000 Jews in Cincinnati. It's a big chunk of the American Jewish population, the fourth largest community in America. And Wise rejected the overtures to join the Republican Party, possibly because of its know-nothing anti-immigrant wing. So here he is, a person who came from Bohemia, from the Czech lands in 1846. He's only been in the country a decade and a half. Most of his constituents haven't been in the country very long. And here the Republicans are seen as anti-immigrant. So he can't align himself with that group. Instead, in the 1860 election, he takes the attitude of a pox on both your houses. You're both terrible, the Democrats and the Republicans. And he predicts peace. Of course, he was horribly wrong. Peace did not break out. War broke out. But he was willing to take money for his newspaper subscription in whatever currency is accepted in any state, in the Union or the Confederacy. So money is, you know, cash is king. He wrote against states' rights, secessionists, but also against abolitionists, meaning he would prefer the Union would be maintained, but he doesn't want to go to war over it and doesn't really care to abolish slavery. Basically, he was anti-Republican and wanted constitutional guarantees for the South to be able to preserve its way of life. However, being that it was unrealistic to pass a constitutional amendment to preserve the way of life in the South, he basically acknowledged that the Union was going to be dissolved and that there was going to be a breakup. But he didn't want there to be a war. Let it be a peaceful breakup. Wise preached on January 4th, 1861, on a day that was declared by President James Buchanan as a national day of fasting and prayer. In the old days when religion played an important role in society, the president could get up and announce, we're having a Tanis Sibur, we're having a national day of fasting, we'll read Vayechal at Mincha, okay, in America that day. So what was the point of a national day of fasting? Somehow, some way with divine intervention, the Union would be held together and there wouldn't be conflict. So Wise, like all the other rabbis and all the other preachers of every Christian denomination, gave a sermon that day. But he didn't give a sermon in his own shul. He gave a sermon in a neighboring shul in Cincinnati, together with Dr. Max Lilienthal, his fellow rabbi in Cincinnati. Why? Because in his shul, they didn't want him talking politics from the pulpit. They didn't like it. It rubbed them the wrong way. Or there was a mixed bag of opinions, and you don't want to alienate congregants, and then they'll resign membership and not pay dues, and the shul won't be viable. So you always have to worry. You don't want to lose members. Okay. So political preaching was not tolerated from his pulpit. And instead, he went to another pulpit, and he emphasized in that sermon and in most of the writings in his newspaper the pettier aspects of the national controversy, meaning he blamed politicians, he blamed office holders, greedy speculators, jobbers, brokers, merchants. In other words, he made it all into a financial issue and a grotesque issue of the venality of people in political life. He never addressed the morality of the slavery issue. In other words, the big lofty issues of human rights and human dignity and the fate of the black population in America, that didn't cross his lips, and it was not addressed by his pen and paper. Okay, so what was Wise's position on slavery? Some claimed that he agreed with Morris Raphael. Morris Raphael, as we'll see tonight, was the rabbi of B'nai Jeshurun, BJ, in New York, which at that time was an Orthodox synagogue. Today, of course, is a conservative synagogue. And Raphael, although a northerner, was pro-slavery and famously sermonized on that national fast day in favor of biblical legitimacy for slavery. So some said Wise was of the same opinion. You know, the Bible says it's okay. However, that's not really true. Wise denied that the Bible supported the modern institution of slavery, and he also denied that blacks were the son of Ham, you know, the B'nai Ham, from the three sons of Noah, the Shem, Ham, and Yafes. But he was okay, nonetheless, with perpetuating slavery in order to preserve peace. He thought that the abolitionists were bigoted hypocrites. As I mentioned before, he thought they were anti-Semites. Well, they're hypocrites. On the one hand, they say we're in favor of human rights for the downtrodden peoples. On the other hand, they're anti-Jewish. And the Jews are historically a beleaguered people, so how come they shouldn't get rights too? That was his perspective. Wise feared that any tampering with existing state or federal constitutions would compromise the status quo, and the status quo gave the Jews full rights. Now, was it really true that the Jews had rights from the beginning of time in America? No, we discussed this at some length over the last 2 months, that the emancipation of American Jewry at the federal and at state levels took time. It was not in one fell swoop. And in fact, we're going to discuss tonight, Maryland was one of the later states in 1826 to finally fully emancipate Jews. But by the 1850s, 1850s, late 1850s, 1861, Jews have full rights in America. And if you mess around with the Constitution, you never know where that's going to lead. So better to leave it alone in the viewpoint of Wise. He also was a middle-of-the-roader. So Debbie's asking, I thought the Jewish abolitionists were by and large reform. Yes, that is true, that the Jewish abolitionists tended to either be reform Jews or atheists. There were only a handful of Orthodox abolitionists. Really, Sabbatot Moraes was really the only one. But not all reform rabbis were abolitionists. In fact, some, especially in the South, had no objections whatsoever to the Southern way of life. So there are those who would argue that Isaac Mayer Wise was a middle of the roader, that he was not a radical leftist and certainly wasn't a right winger either religiously, that he was a middle of the road guy when it came to politics, in the sense that he wasn't vigorously pro-Union or vigorously pro-Confederacy, but rather some wishy-washy position in between, just as he was wishy-washy in the middle of the road when it comes to religious ritual. That's what some of the scholarship says. However, that scholarship is being written by non-Orthodox people who view Wise as somewhere in the middle religiously. From a traditional point of view, Isaac Mayer Wise was a chazer fresser, okay? He was a Michal Shabbos. He was not from in the least. So I wouldn't call him middle of the road when it comes to religion. In any event, Wise saw that the abolitionists were the same Christian fundamentalists who would restrict liquor traffic, institute Sunday blue laws, and try to make Christianity a state religion. So he was afraid of that. And every Jew should be afraid of that. You know, we don't want church-state combinations with some Protestant denomination becoming the official state religion. We don't want blue laws. We certainly don't want to ban the trafficking of booze. We have to have a kiddush, you know? So Wise deplored secession. However, he felt that the states had a right to do it. So having done it, he wasn't going to object to it. He adopted a policy of silence throughout the war. His newspaper did not discuss the war. Okay, now that leads to absurd outcomes. How do you have a newspaper, an American Jewish newspaper, in 1861 and 62, not discussing the war? Well, what are you going to talk about? What they served at the Shalashudis and, you know, in Milwaukee? I mean, what are they going to write about in the newspaper, if not the war? And yet somehow he danced around the war. Okay. He lost subscribers to his newspaper. Northerners were angry that he wasn't sufficiently pro-Union, and Southerners were cut off and couldn't get the paper. Wise was angry at the Postmaster General for interdicting mail going to the South. I guess he thought it was unconstitutional for the Postmaster General to interfere with the postal services to Southern states. But I guess Wise didn't realize that total war means total war, and you don't get your mail delivered. Okay. Wise was nominated by the Democrats for a state Senate seat in September of 1863, as I mentioned, but the shul board told him, you can't take the job. You have to come to davening every day and teach the kids in the cheder. All right, so he walked away from politics, but not completely, just for his own holding public office. That never came to pass. Okay, so that's enough with Isaac Mayer Wise. He's not the only rabbi. There are other important people whose opinions matter, and let's examine that now. So there's no ecclesiastical hierarchy in America, certainly not for American Judaism. And so every individual synagogue and every individual rabbi was free to opine on the questions of slavery, secession, and war, and to come to wildly different outcomes. Morris Raphael, as I mentioned, in New York, speaking on January 4th, defended slavery on the basis of the Ten Commandments. Where is slavery in the Ten Commandments? It's there twice. Where? Who knows? In which of the Ten Commandments is there slavery?
Thou shalt not steal.
You're supposed to let everybody rest, including
on Shabbos. Good. Okay. On Shabbos, it says, "Yom Hashvi Shabbat LaHashem Elokecha, lo tase kol melacha." Avdecha v'matcha v'mtecha v'gercha shebisharecha. Where else?
Thou shalt not steal.
No. Not stealing. No.
Be jealous. Don't be jealous of your neighbor.
Thou shalt not covet. Bingo. Lo tachmot beit reyecha. Lo tachmot eishet reyecha. Okay, so in two of the Ten Commandments, you have reference to male and female slave population. So on that basis, and other things we'll see in a moment, we're going to go in depth into Raphael's arguments, he defended slavery. Other rabbis... rabbis regarded it as blasphemy because they took a more contextual view, adopting the spirit of the law rather than the letter of the law. There were rabbis for every conceivable political position. Some supported the North, some supported the South, some wanted peace above all, some wanted victory of a certain principle, even if it meant war. Okay, so let's examine carefully the situation in Baltimore. Why Baltimore? Well,
it's on the border.
The border. It's a southern town that never goes Confederate, for reasons which I'll explain. So
slaveholding
was split. It was the established German Jewish elite traded heavily with the South. Asher is asking, were the immigrant rabbis from the emancipated Europe a natural base for abolitionists? Yet why were the Jews opposed Lincoln? Okay, so Asher, the answer to that is that some of the rabbis who escaped Europe or who voluntarily left Europe were in favor of abolition, and they had strong ideological opinions, but not everyone. Okay, so Baltimore had an established Jewish German element that favored slavery because it was economically beneficial. Their commercial ties were to the slave states, which what would become the Confederacy, and they didn't want to rock the boat. The liberal Jews who participated in the revolutions of 1848 in Europe and who left Europe, oftentimes they were forced to leave Europe, they were run out of Europe because they were sort of persona non grata after participating in a revolutionary movement. So they favored abolition. In other words, if the progressive revolutions, political revolutions in Europe in 1830 and 1848 were all about bringing civil rights and political rights to the masses, including to the beleaguered ethno-religious underclass, well, then in America, who's the beleaguered underclass? The Negro slave population. They deserve to have emancipation and full rights. And so that's a logical connection. However, so now, the Orthodox rabbi in Baltimore was Bernard Illouis. Bernard Illouis was politically conservative, just as he was ritually conservative, lowercase c, meaning he was against change. He was averse to change. That if Illouis doesn't want to abolish any minhagim, in other words, even the second you kum porkan, you can't touch it at all. Every line of the sitter is sacrosanct. You can't amend any religious ritual. Well, you don't touch anything. So too, you don't touch the constitutional norms in America. If it allows for slavery, you leave it be, and you allow slavery. That was Illouis' perspective. Okay, David Einhorn, radical progressive reform rabbi, he wanted change in both religion and in politics. So he's not afraid to doctor up the sitter. He's not afraid to do violence to the Shulchan Aruch and to religious ritual. So too, he's not afraid to do violence to the political status quo in America. If he thinks it's immoral, he'll speak up out. He'll speak out against it. Then there's the middle of the road guys. The middle of the roaders are Henry Hochheimer and Benjamin Zold. Benjamin Zold is the father of whom?
Henrietta Zold.
Henrietta Zold, good. So Benjamin Zold is one of the important rabbis of the historical school, the positive historical school of Judaism, which is the forerunner of conservative Judaism. It's neither Orthodox nor extreme reform. It's somewhere down the middle. And just as the middle of the roaders, in terms of the rabbis, had that attitude in terms of ritual, so too they had the attitude in terms of politics. Don't be an extreme abolitionist, and also don't go the other direction of aggressively supporting the maintenance of slavery. Okay, so Jews in Baltimore were part of the larger German community. The expatriate Germans were mostly Democrats, and while not regarding slavery as a divine institution, they were told that the Constitution, which gave them their American rights and freedoms, expressly sanctioned slavery. So among the Germans, even among the Gentiles, the elites were pro-slavery, and the 48ers were anti-slavery. And they regarded America's 1861 moment as the functional equivalent of Europe's 1848 moment. Okay, so as I mentioned, there were the four shuls, and there were five rabbis in town in Baltimore. One of the rabbis did not have a shul. He was retired. That was Abraham Rice. As I mentioned a few weeks ago, Abraham Rice was the first rabbi in America to serve as a pulpit rabbi. But he was retired having gone into the dry goods business because he couldn't make it as a rabbi because no one listened to him and no one wanted to be frum. So he exerted almost no influence. However, Ilui, Bernard Ilui, in the Orthodox congregation, was essentially pro-South. And he openly expressed sympathy with the secessionists. And I want to read to you a quote from one of his sermons. This is Bernard Ilui in 1861. He wrote the following. The ends for which men unite in society and submit to government are to enjoy security for their property and freedom for their persons. Who can blame our brethren of the South for their being inclined to secede from the society under whose government those ends cannot be attained and whose union is kept together by heavy iron ties of violence and arbitrary force? Who can blame our brethren of the South for seceding from a society whose government cannot or will not protect the property rights and privileges of a great portion of the Union against the encroachments of a majority, misguided by some influential, ambitious aspirants and self-politicians, when the color of religion and disguise of philanthropy have thrown the country into a general state of confusion and millions into wanton poverty? So basically what Ilui is saying is, if they're trying to take away your slaves, your property, and they're causing a tumult and war, well, they're the bad guy, not you. You can't blame the Southerners. They just want to have their way of life. So that's Ilui's perspective. When you read that paragraph, it sounds a lot like Senator Mike Lee just said, that, no, this is not a democracy. We're interested in prosperity, peace, and the third thing, I forget. Okay, so the goal is not a virtuous political system, but rather just preserve what I have. My stuff is mine. Don't let the government boss me around and put me in iron chains. Okay, that was Ilui's perspective. He quoted the Bible. He noted that Moses did not prohibit slavery, and that Abraham, the most charitable person ever, Avraham, whose tent was open on all four sides, personally held slaves. All right, well, it's a fair point, you know. That was Ilui's perspective. Benjamin Zold, the middle of the road, positive historical / uppercase C conservative guy, he was new in town. He arrived in 1859 and he pleaded for reconciliation. He said the spirit of the time, which calls for abolition, versus tradition, which was to hold slaves, were in conflict, and he couldn't take a firm stand. So instead, he wrote a lot of gibberish about peace and love. He questioned, is religion about unbendable old laws, or does contemporary thinking play a role? And in the end, he concludes, well, the middle ground position is it's a little bit of both. But he does not articulate a specific policy. So in this respect, Benjamin Zold's attitude towards slavery is a forerunner for what? For the conservative movement's attitude towards halakha more generally.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
You understand?
Yeah.
You can't take a position, so essentially you take no position, which is a wishy-washy middle ground position. Okay. Now, it's not surprising that the name of his shul was Ohev Shalom, lovers of peace. Uh-huh. They don't come to a definitive position on policy, but we let's love peace. Let's all get along. Okay. He wanted the Union to be preserved at any price, which might even mean acquiescing to slavery, although he didn't especially like slavery, but he wants peace and he wants union. Okay, now we go to Einhorn. Einhorn arrived in America in 1855, and he immediately began preaching about human equality and the need to battle the forces of darkness in the world. He founded a monthly publication called Sinai, to espouse his views. He accused the Southern Protestant churches of not having an independent voice for morality and instead being mere adjuncts to the ruling political party, kind of like evangelicals in the Trump era. In other words, you're too tied to the party and not taking stands on moral issues. So Einhorn believed in a complete separation of church and state, but not, and listen to this one, but not a complete separation of religion and state. After all, religion should permeate every facet of life. Of course, you could ask the question, where's the international border between religion and church? I mean, it's kind of arbitrary. He says, church and state don't mix, but religion and state, that mixes. Yeah, but who says? Well, what is religion? Okay. Einhorn devoted four essays to critiquing Morris Raphael's defense of slavery. And Einhorn was great at hurling invective, and he called Raphael every nasty name under the sun without using any four-letter words. I mean, like, you know, elevated man's, cerebral man's put-downs. Plus, he called it a chilul Hashem. Einhorn regarded slavery as the cancer of the Union, and he thought that everyone should be an abolitionist, but especially Jews, in light of our national history and our religious tradition. Okay. Were rabbis involved in the Underground Railroad? Not to my knowledge. I mean, maybe some, but there were Jews involved, but I don't think rabbis were involved. Okay. He was shot. No, this is an important point. Last week, I asked you a question. I said it's one thing for the old line Sephardic families in the South to favor slavery because they might have been heavy-duty slaveholders and might have held plantations or been rich. But what about the newly arrived Ashkenazic Jews from Central Europe who did not have this this memory of 100 years of slavery? What was their attitude towards the institution of slavery in the American South in the 1840s and 1850s? And there was a big machlokas between, I think, Norman and Asher and Jeff and everyone else listening in about what they thought the attitude of the Ashkenazim was going to be. And in the end, we concluded that while some preserved a certain moral stance of anti-slavery, plenty of the new arrivals just blended right in for economic reasons, supported whatever was the policy of the, you know, in the land of their dispersion. So when Einhorn got to America, he was aghast. How could it be that Yossele and Chaimichael, who was in Europe with me 5 minutes ago, now when they get to Mobile, Alabama, or Memphis, or New Orleans, or Atlanta, suddenly they're the biggest proponents of slavery? He couldn't fathom. How could that be? How could that be? He thought it was a shanda.
Rabbi?
Yeah.
Hi. So I have a question. So when there are these canards from people like Farrakhan himself, that the Jews were involved in slave trade, which is even worse, I think, than owning slaves.
Right.
That's, you know, it's pretty hard to dispel that argument the way you describe that period of history.
Well, I think that it's important to note that Jews were not heavily involved in the slave trade. They were involved to the extent that, yeah, there were Jews in that line of work, but they were not the major players by any stretch of the imagination. And so it's just, it's convenient to blame whatever ethno-religious group you don't like for having participated in an institution which was deplorable, because everybody participated in it, and you just cherry-pick who you don't like and blame them. That's the honest truth about blaming Jews for Southern slavery. Jews played an infinitesimal role in the whole thing.
One of the things I recall is that with the new Christians, who are the slave traders in the 17th century, Jews were not allowed to own the property to become slave traders. And also there was, in the 19th century, there was only one family, Davis, I think, that was a large slave trader.
Right, it's true, The Davis family out of Richmond and Petersburg, they were the only one of any significance. Okay, so let's continue. And Eli mentions that in the shul in Charleston, the rabbi gave a drasha in favor of slavery. People say they never missed a minyan during the Civil War. Wow, that's pretty good. We missed a bunch of minyanim, you know, for a pandemic, but they never missed one for the Civil War. Wow, that's frum. So, in any event, Einhorn complained that in America there were many synagogues and many churches, but very little religion and very little morality. In other words, it's an institutional religion, but no real religion. No, meaning religion guided by morality. So, the Gentiles cared what the rabbis had to say, and Raphael's words were widely distributed in the South, and Einhorn's words were widely distributed in the North. What about good old Isaac Leiser? You know, Isaac Leiser, we spent a whole session on him, the traditional Chazan in Philadelphia, the Kolbo who put out literature and translated the Bible and translated the Siddur. What was his perspective? He had an interesting line. He said, In the synagogue, we want Jews. In public matters, we want Americans. In other words, your Judaism shouldn't be influencing your perspective on the hot button issues of the day politically in America. Is that a reasonable perspective?
Yes.
For those times, maybe, you know, be a Jew at home and...
Tina, you hit the nail on the head.
Yeah, it was...
You in the home and a man in the street.
Right, like, who's that, Gordon?
Masculine perspective.
Was that Gordon who said that?
That was Yehuda Leib Gordon who said that. Correct, correct.
Okay.
So Leiser had this perspective, which basically divorces morality from the policy viewpoint of the American Jew. And Einhorn forcefully rejects that idea. And to him, he says, Jews had to fight not only for their own emancipation, but for the emancipations of all peoples. In other words, you can't just look out for number one. You got to look out for everybody, including the guy at the bottom. And the guy at the bottom right now is the slave. Okay. So what was so dangerous about saying these sorts of things in Maryland? So the answer is that Jews first got their rights in Maryland in 1826. So their emancipation was only 30 years old. The situation was very precarious. Protests developed around Einhorn, and the Jewish community was pressured to disassociate itself from their own rabbi, okay? So the rabbi was getting the community in trouble. Well, only a few years earlier, Max Sutro, who was the clergyman at Har Sinai Varim, which was Einhorn's shul, the Reform shul, so his predecessor, had abolished Tisha B'Av. Why did he abolish Tisha B'Av? Not because he was one of these Fabrenta anti-Zionists who doesn't believe in the restoration of Israel. I mean, maybe he didn't believe in it, but the reason why he abolished Tisha B'Av was he was afraid if we observe Tisha B'Av, the Goyim are going to watch and they're going to see that we're praying for the restoration of an ancient homeland and they're going to accuse us of being insufficiently patriotic towards America, our new homeland. So better we should not observe the holiday, the fast day, until we've blended in enough that nobody's going to accuse us of a lack of patriotism. And then we'll bring back Tisha B'Av. So that was Sutro's theory. So they really are worried. What are the Goyim going to say? What are the Goyim going to think if we do things that seem less than fully patriotic? And patriotic means not for America, but for the sectional interests of the American South. Okay. So the Jews were worried. And Einhorn understood that he was endangering the community. He was no fool. It's not like he was like a pie in the sky and had his head in the clouds and didn't realize the danger of what he was doing. He knew full well. He thought, nonetheless, despite the danger, it's the right thing to do. You take a moral stand and you stick with it even when it's inconvenient. Okay. He emphasized also the need for the Jews to fight against the Jewish Amalekites. Who are the Jewish Amalekites? Well, whoever you don't like, but I mean, who are the Jewish Amalekites? So the answer is the smugglers who will give the Jews a bad name, a shame ra. You know, there are the Jews who take advantage of wartime situations, of profiteering, and they give the Jews a very bad name. Okay. Now, it was dangerous to be pro-union in Baltimore. Lincoln, in the 1860 election, won only 2,000 votes out of 92,000 votes in Maryland. So he really was unpopular in the state.
But why didn't they join the Confederacy?
I'll explain right now. So people pretended to be rebels just to fit in and not to get hurt because Baltimore was a mob town. And I don't mean like Vito Corleone. I mean mob in the sense of a mob violence, that people with pitchforks and flames would go after you if you held a political position that was against the dominant view. So violence in the streets could determine political outcomes. Maryland voted in 1860 to secede from the Union if the chance ever presented itself, meaning before South Carolina did anything, already in 1860, Maryland said, you know, we're going to go with the South if there is a breakup of the Union. However, in September of 1861, Lincoln sent in the federal marshals to arrest all the state legislators in Maryland so that they couldn't convene in the state capitol and vote to secede. So Maryland would have seceded, but if not for like a stunt pulled by the Northern Army.
Say that Trump.
So why was the North so adamant that Maryland not be able to secede from the Union? Well, because Washington, D.C. would be surrounded otherwise by Confederacy, and the railroad lines from Washington to the North all ran through Baltimore. So it was absolutely essential that Baltimore be held on held onto by the North, even though the sentiment on the street in Baltimore was very much in the other direction. Okay, so on the night of April 19th, 1861, the mob destroyed the offices of the German weekly paper, the Wecker, which was a progressive paper that favored abolition, and they destroyed the offices of Sinai, of Einhorn's Jewish publication, German Jewish publication, that also was, of course, favoring abolition. So the Einhorn's congregants told him, you got to get out of town, buddy. You know, you got to run. Run for your life. And Einhorn, the good rabbi that he was, did not want to abandon his flock. You know, you don't abandon your sheep. But rather, you stay, you go down with the ship. So he refused to go. To which they responded, listen, your life and the life of your family is in danger, and we want you out of here. Get out. We don't like you here anymore. So he got the message, and he hightailed it out of there with his family to Philadelphia. He was invited back to Baltimore in May, late May, in time for Shavuos, but on one condition, that he not preach on the excitable issues of the day. That's a great expression, the excitable issues of the day. So now there are plenty of rabbis who for Parnassa would say, sure, fine, I won't talk about the excitable issues of the day. I'll give a shir on Kiddush B'Makom Suda. You know, I'll give some innocuous topic in Talmudic law. But no, not David Einhorn. For David Einhorn, the pulpit was to preach morality. And if he couldn't do it, it was Nishkan pulpit. Okay, so he wasn't going back to Baltimore. He was very bitter about it. He was very bitter that he was being muzzled by his own congregants. But he's going to stay in Philadelphia. What does he do in Philadelphia? Well, he becomes the rabbi of Knesset Israel congregation, where he stays there for the next 5 years until 1866 when he moves to New York and becomes the rabbi in Bethel. But he also restarts his publication, Sinai. And it lasts for about another year. But then, because of lack of subscribers and lack of money, it goes out of business. And in the last issue of Sinai, he wrote in very, over-the-top terms, he said, Sinai dies in the battle against slavery. Sinai is in Mount Sinai, not just paper, but Mount Sinai, Judaic morality dies in the battle against slavery. So, Einhorn was a fan of Abraham Lincoln's. He liked Lincoln. He regarded him as a messiah of his people and the high priest of freedom. However, in his eulogy for Lincoln, after Lincoln gets shot by John Wilkes Booth, there's one criticism of Lincoln by Einhorn. He said, you were too soft on the rebels, meaning too conciliatory. You should have really bludgeoned them but good and scorched earth in the South. So he would have liked General Sherman's approach. Uh-huh. So now let's go to Morris Raphael's speech from January 4th, 1861, the one that got so much press attention and was widely popular in the South, despite him being in the North. And then we'll go through Einhorn's response, which was a very sharp-worded response. So Raphael begins with the setting is the Book of Jonah, Book of Jonah. You know, we just read it, Yom Kippur, Mincha time, Book of Jonah. What happens in the book of Jonah? Jonah goes to Nineveh and says, if you don't repent in 40 days, the world is going to, you know, your city is going to be overturned. Nehepachet will be overturned. Your civilization will come to an end. And what happens? The king of Nineveh then issues an order to all of his citizenry that they should fast and wear sackcloth, and even the dogs wore sackcloth and fasted, okay, and return the stolen property that you stole from your neighbor. Okay, so there's a lot of teshuvah, and in the end, Nineveh isn't destroyed. So Raphael says, the king, the city of Nineveh heeded Jonah's words and avoided a calamity. If the north and the south, respectively, heed the words of the Bible, then war can be averted. So people think in the south that cotton is king. They're wrong. People in the north, the abolitionists, think that thought, progressive thought, is the king. They're wrong. Who's the king? God is the king. Melech Malchei Amlachim HaKadosh Baruch Hu U'Malchuto B'Kol Mashalah. Then, the question of whether slaveholding is a sin before God, he writes, is one that belongs to the theologians. Now, in modern America, who cares whether something is a sin against God? We don't determine our politics on the basis of old world religion. And even the evangelicals don't. It's baloney. But in the 1850s, they did. And so the notion that the theologian has a role to play in public discourse was pretty much universally accepted. This is not Raphael getting on a high horse that he doesn't belong on. It's accepted at the time. Then he says, I have been requested by prominent citizens of other denominations that I should on this day examine the Bible view of slavery as the religious mind of the country requires to be enlightened on the subject. So he's saying, I'm not just doing this because I want to give a sermon in a shul, but rather that the Gentiles of various denominations have come to me and said, please, Rabbi, Jewish preacher, clarify what is the Jewish view. We want to know. So he says that slavery originated in war, and it was around before the deluge, the antediluvian period, before the flood. How does he know this? Because Noah already knew about slavery. Noah says to his grandson Ham, "Vayomer Arur Kenan, Eved Avadim Yalecha," that Kenan, the father of Ham, who either saw Noah naked or castrated him, whatever he did to him, shall be Eved Avadim, a slave of slaves. So how does Noah know about the concept of slavery? It must be that in the pre-Mabel era, there already was slavery. So if you're asking from a historical point of view, chronological point of view, Raphael says that there was slavery in the very, very deep antiquity. What's his goal here? His goal here is to prove the legitimacy of the institution in modern times, or then modern times, 1861, by saying it goes back to as far as anybody can remember, and even deeper than that, to the deepest yore. And he says, Africans are doomed as the descendants of Ham. Eved Avadim Yalechav, Ham is cursed. Then he says, Arabs are wild and violent descendants of Yishmael. Who ye pera adam, yadoba kol, v'yar, kol?
Wow.
Good. So all the racial stereotypes that you could impose upon the Bible, he's doing it. If somebody were to say this today, they'd lose their job. They'd be on the newspaper for being a bigot. All right, so he says the Africans are cursed because of Ham. The Arabs are Vildachayas. Yafet, the Europeans, came to dominate the earth, and they learned some religion from Shem, but that, generally speaking, religion in the world, if it's known at all, is known from the descendants of Shem, meaning the Jews, the Abrahamic religions. Okay. Then he says, abolitionism, something unknown to our predecessors, that our predecessors in the Jewish generations past could not have fathomed someone claiming that slaveholding is a sin. And he quotes the pasuk from Parshas Ha'azinu, Yizbechu la'ashedim lo eloha, Elohim lo yida'um, chadashim mikarov ba'u, new things came, lo se'arum avotechem, that our ancestors could not have even fathomed. That this idea of slaveholding as a sin is an invention of then modern times. Okay. He quotes the commandments about Shabbos, the commandments about not coveting. Okay, and then he says, Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov all owned slaves. And then he issues a little bit of a caveat. He says, look, I am no friend to slavery in the abstract, and still less friendly to the practical workings of slavery. But I stand here as a teacher in Israel, not to place before you my own feelings and opinions, but to propound to you the word of God, the Bible view of slavery. Meaning, I'm not making this up as I go along, but rather, this is what the Word of God is according to the Bible. You're asking me what is the Word of God. I'm not offering you the Raphael filter. I'm giving you the unvarnished version. That's what he's claiming. Question was, what was the position of the Catholic Church on slavery? So the Catholic Church in America was not especially pro-slavery, but also was not involved in the abolition movement in the least. And in fact, to have Irish Catholics in the Irish movement basically failed. So, they just they muddled along. There were Catholic churches in every part of the country.
Yeah, I don't
based
know.
Upon sectional,
very peculiar. Very peculiar. Yeah.
Rabbi.
Can you mute us, please?
Rabbi.
So,
Tina was asking a question. Yeah, Tina, unmute yourself. Oh, well, okay. So now he then continues. But he acknowledges that there are two different kinds of slaves.
Right. And a lot of qualifications.
Yeah.
That go into owning a slave. You know, there's a saying, "Koneh eved, koneh adon latzmo."
Correct. Correct. And Rafal quotes that Gemara. In the very next paragraph, he quotes the Gemara.
Right.
So the concept of slavery, you only work for 6 years, or you only work until the Jubilee. And if you purchase a Hebrew servant, it's like you purchase a master for yourself, because there's so many restrictions on what you can do with that person. Right.
And he didn't talk
however, that. Okay, so there's no comparison then between an eved ivri and chattel slavery in the American South. However, Rafal claims there is a comparison that you can draw between Eved Kenani and the slave in the American South. That slaves, like real property, are handed down from one generation to the next forever. Le'olam bahem ta'avodu, as it says in the Torah. However, Rafal then backtracks again. He says, even in the case of Eved Kenani, however, there's a difference between that and the American South, the slave in the American South.
That's right.
The Eved Kenani is a person, not a thing. And he has rights and he has protections. Right. He can't be physically abused. If you knock out his tooth or his eye, he goes free. Shane Vayin, he goes free. Right. He can't be sexually abused and he can't be overworked in the sense that the Eved Kenani has to keep Shabbos. He's not allowed to work on Shabbos.
Right.
Contrast, the slave in Roman society and then by extension the American South was considered a thing, not a person, and lacked any and all rights. So what Rafal concluded was, Northerners need to give up on the notion that slaveholding is a sin. It's not a sin, he says. And Southerners need to give up the heathen form of slavery and restore the more gentle and kindly form of biblical slavery. That's his spiel. So his conclusion basically is, neither side is getting it 100% right. There is misinformation on both sides. But we could preserve the Union and preserve a form of slavery which would keep the South happy as long as it fits the biblical paradigm. Okay. Now let's go to Einhorn's response. So Einhorn has a bunch of zingers that I want to quote directly because he says it better than I could say it. He asked the question, slavery a moral evil, or is it not a moral evil? And he says like this, it took Dr. Rafal, a Jewish preacher, to concoct the deplorable farce in the name of divine authority to proclaim the justification, the moral blamelessness of servitude, and to lay down the law to Christian preachers of opposite convictions. In other words, it's like a disgrace that here a Jew is being questioned by the Christian clergy about what the policy should be on slavery, and he's telling the Christians, well, we can have a very relaxed standard and hold slaves. Ashanda, the Jew, a descendant of the race that offers daily praises to God for deliverance out of the house of bondage, you know, it's Zecher Liyetzias Mitzrayim, which we say a lot, okay, and even today suffers under the yoke of slavery in most places in the old world, meaning Jews were not yet emancipated in 1861 in much of Eastern Europe and the Middle East. So there are plenty of, there are millions of Jews who are still suffering under the boot of harsh tyrants. Okay. So crying out to God, he undertook to designate slavery as perfectly sinless institution sanctioned by God. So that's Einhorn's opening salvo against Rafal. But the chutzpah of this guy to say as a Jew that it's okay to hold slaves given our past and even our present in certain parts of the world. Then, says it must be confessed that this evidence as given is presented in a very ingenious manner, that he acknowledges Rafal as a logician does a good job of making his case. It's an obscene case, but the logic, can, you know, you can follow it step by step, and its skill exceeds the capacity already admired by our ancients to drive a camel through a needle's eye, meaning he has a tough challenge, this guy, Rafal. He wants to declare moral the immoral, so he has to pass a large item through the eye of a needle. And somehow, he thinks he got away with it. Okay. Then Einhorn debunks the idea that slavery was an institution in human civilization from the days before Noah, before the flood. that Raphael had claimed, oh, it was around since the days before Noach. So Einhorn responds that Raphael's interpretation is really absurd. And, quote, evidently, owing to his remembrance of the conditions prior to the deluge, ergo, Negro slavery must have been dominant before the great catastrophe. We are vividly reminded of Jewish clowns who delighted wedding guests did all sorts of leaps in the domain of drasha. In other words, the badchan at a Jewish wedding in the old world would tell jokes to make people laugh, right? The badchan at a wedding would tell jokes. So sometimes the badchan was like a shtickle rabbi, and he was like a darshan, and he would do like shalashudas Torah, Purim Torah at a wedding to make people laugh. What Einhorn is saying is that Raphael's speech that he gave and was so popular is no better than Purim Torah. It's even worse than Shalashudas Torah. Okay? So, then, he denies the idea that the Negro is a descendant of Canaan or Ham, but rather, on the basis of language and geography, Einhorn concludes that the blacks of sub-Saharan Africa are either original Semites or Eastern Japhetites from Japhet, and they are not from Ham. Where was Ham? What land of the what country in the world is Ham? Who knows? Mitzrayim. Mitzrayim is the land of Ham, not sub-Saharan Africa. Okay. Then is Einhorn's most important paragraph, where he's responding to Raphael, but really stating a much more, a bigger point. Quote, the question exclusively to be decided is whether scripture merely tolerates this institution as an evil not to be disregarded, and therefore infuses in it its legislation a mild spirit gradually leading to dissolution, or whether it favors, approves, and justifies and sanctions it in its moral aspect. Meaning, yeah, there's slavery in the Bible, but is it because the Bible thinks that slavery is good and moral, or because slavery was around in human civilization in the days when the Bible was being promulgated, and the Bible had to take into account the fact that it did exist? It couldn't in one fell swoop abolish it, but the Bible did its best to remove the worst abuses of slavery and make it a more gentle institution, leading eventually to its complete dissolution. So which of the two is it? Is slavery okay and good in the eyes of the Bible, or is slavery simply tolerated because of circumstance, but preferably to be eliminated? That's the real question. And as far as Einhorn is concerned, it's no question at all. Mishkan Kasha. Of course, the trajectory of the Bible is towards a progressive outcome, not to espouse the morality of slavery, but rather to say, yeah, it exists, but we'd rather it didn't exist. And we're going to march every generation, every century, towards its eventual dissolution. Okay. Then another attack on Raphael. Had Dr. Raphael searched for the spirit of the law of God, he would have given due honor to it instead of going back to the deluge merely to produce a slave. He would have preferred to trace his way back as far as the history of creation, where the golden words shine, God created man in his image. B'tselem Elohim Barata Adam. Okay? So, as far as Einhorn is concerned, God's words of B'tselem Elohim far outweighs Noach's curse of Eved Avadim Yelechav. What's more important, God's words or Noach's words? Clearly, God's words, Tselem Elohim, that even the slave, the African slave, is Tselem Elohim, and therefore worthy of equality. He then quotes a few pieces from the davening. V'yishtachavu lefanecha kol habruim, v'yasu chulam aguda achat. We're supposed to be one aguda, not agudas Yisrael, you know, but rather aguda achat, all of humanity, like we say in the davening on the high holidays. And yomar kol asher neshama b'yapo, everyone who has neshama b'yapo, soul, a breath in his life, is supposed to be together in one unified human entity, worshiping the Lord. Then he quotes a pasuk, Lo tasgir eved el Adonav. What does that mean? Lo tasgir eved el Adonav.
To return a runaway slave.
Correct. So don't return a runaway slave. he found that the Bible is a polar opposite from the Dred Scott decision.
Uh-huh.
The notion of runaway, fugitive slave laws and very extreme fugitive slave laws. Like, you know, even if you make it all the way to the north, if you make it to Canada, we'll find you, we'll hunt you down, we'll bring you back, we'll kill you. Horrible compared to Lo Tazkir Eved El Adonav. And then the last paragraph. And in the last paragraph, he really puts Rafal in his place. He says this: I am no politician and do not meddle in politics. But to proclaim slavery in the name of Judaism to be a God-sanctioned institution, the Jewish religious press must raise objections to this if it does not want itself and Judaism branded forever. Meaning, we can't allow a preacher, a Jewish preacher of some renown, to espouse a view that we think is totally off the wall and wrong, because if he does that and we don't speak out against it, everyone else beyond the Jewish fold will say, oh, it must be that guy's right. And that becomes the official position of Judaism. We cannot let that happen, he says. So as a pamphleteer, as a publisher of a newspaper, a member of the press, the media, Einhorn, not just as a rabbi, but as a member of the press, has to disabuse the public of Rafael's notions. Then, had a Christian clergyman in Europe delivered the Rafael address, the Jewish Orthodox, as well as the Jewish Reform Press, would have been set going to call the wrath of heaven and earth upon such falsehoods, to denounce such disgrace in Chilul Hashem. And yet we in America are to ignore the mischief done by a Jewish preacher? So basically what he's saying is that what Rafael said was so obscene, and was being said in the name of Judaism. If a galach, if a Christian minister in Europe had claimed that the Jewish view of slavery is what Rafael claimed it was, everyone, the Jewish Reform and the Jewish Orthodox, would have cried foul and screamed and yelled and hollered and said, you're wrong, it's not true, it's not true. So if that would be the response, if a goy did it, alachas kama v'kama, all the more so if a Jewish rabbi does it, then we have to say, you're wrong. Okay. Only such Jews who prize the dollar more highly than their God and their religion can demand or even approve this. Meaning, Einhorn is saying is, every Jew in his heart knows that he's supposed to be an abolitionist. So anyone who's not an abolitionist, anyone who is cheerleading Rafael's arguments about the legitimacy of slavery, must be motivated by the mighty dollar. There is a this-worldly, an olam hazeh motivation for any opposition to Einhorn's own viewpoint. Okay. Eli says, it's interesting no one is quoting a Rishon or an Achron. Yeah, it's not surprising at all, because the reformers tend not to quote Rishonim and Achronim, and Rafael himself is not really a rabbi, he's just a preacher. He wasn't really Talmudically educated that well. So they like the Bible, they like the commentaries on the Bible, maybe they like the Midrash a little bit, but quoting Rishonim and Achronim is not their bag. It's not, you're not going to find that. Maybe from Illui or from Abraham Rice, from the real Musmachim, the real Orthodox rabbis. So to them, the Rishonim and Achronim may play a role, or most of the Rishonim, not the Achronim. But for the Jewish clergy who are outside of the orbit of the old world Orthodoxy, they're not going to be quoting Piskei Halacha from the later literature. Not going to happen. Okay, any questions? Okay, no questions. So on that note, we'll stop here. Next week, we're going to do Grant's General Order Number 11, when they were expelled from the whole department of the country.
Okay.
Most egregious anti-Semitic action taken during the war. And we'll examine what was the aftermath of that that decree, and how did it affect the Jewish relationship to General Grant when, after the war, he ran for president. And why? Was he hated by the Jews, or was he beloved by the Jews? We'll continue next week.
Rabbi?
Yeah.
Rabbi,
yeah.
You mentioned that the abolitionists had within them a strain of people who were anti-Jewish.
Yeah.
Why? What's the thinking here? I don't understand that.
Christian Protestant theology, which views the Jew in a negative light as a Christ killer, or as a rejecter of the messiahship of Jesus, and yet otherwise favors universal human equality, meaning the black man didn't do anything wrong. The slave may even be a Christian. many of the slaves wholeheartedly adopted Christianity in some formation or another. And that's why after the war in the American South, the black church was a big deal. So the black man is not a sinner, but the Jew is.
So they were really a religious group, the abolitionists.
For the most part, yes. There were some who were agnostic or atheistic and just had some sort of enlightenment view that says that slaveholding, you know, human slaveholding is bad. But that was not the dominant element. The dominant element was a religious abolitionism.
Okay.
So you had somebody like Garrison. I mean, like, he went full throttle against the Jews.
Yeah. He was not afraid to use the Shylock terms and all the other nasty rhetoric.
But the other thing was, I think he was equally against the papists.
Yes, because the papists don't have the right type of Christianity. So they're guilty of theological error. So the bottom line is, race is not a problem. Theological error is a problem.
Well, could you say that about the evangelicals today?
You could, but they tend to not focus on the theological error. They tend to focus on sort of biblical notions of whoever blesses me, I will bless. Whoever curses me, I will curse. And so their relationship to the Jew, in the body of the Jew, is more favorable now than it was 150 years ago.
Yeah.
In addition to that, the evangelicals think that the Jews have to really inherit Eretz Yisrael before they get it. So that's one of the reasons they're on our side. Yeah. Very big supporters.
Bless his Emes. It's true. It's true. Okay, folks. Everybody have a good night. Take care.
Thank you so much. Thank you.